The Tower Treasure, credited to the non-existent Franklin W. Dixon, and ghostwritten by Leslie McFarlane. Chapter 12, Days of Waiting. Fenton Hardy had high hopes of a quick solution of the mystery when he went to New York. Possession of the wig, the hat and the coat gave him three clues, any one of which might lead to tracing the previous owner quickly, and the detective was confident that it would not be long before he would unravel the tangled threads. He had not stated his optimism to the boys, being careful not to arouse their hopes, but in his heart he thought it would be but a matter of hours before he ran the owner of the red wig to earth. But obstacles presented themselves before him in bewildering succession. The wig appeared to be his chief clue, and when he arrived in the city he went directly to the head office of the company that had manufactured it. When he sent his card in to the manager he was readily admitted, for Fenton Hardy's name was known from the Atlantic to the Pacific. "Some of our customers in trouble, Mr. Hardy?" asked the manager, when the great detective tossed the red wig on his desk. "Not yet. But one of your customers will be in trouble if I can ever trace the purchaser of this wig." The manager picked it up. He inspected it carefully and frowned. "We are not, as you know, a wig-making firm," he said. "That is, the wig department is a very small sideline with us." "The very reason I thought it would be easier to trace this," replied Mr. Hardy. "If you turned out thousands of them every year it might be more difficult. You sell to an exclusive theatrical trade, I believe." "Exactly. If an actor wants a wig of some special nature, we do our best to please him. We only make the wigs to order." "Then you will probably have a record of this one." The manager turned the wig over in his hands, glanced carefully at the inside, felt of the weight and texture, then pressed a button at the side of his desk. A boy came and departed with a message. "It may be difficult. This wig is not new. In fact, I would say it was turned out about 2 years ago. A long time. But still, I'll do the best I can." A bespectacled old man shuffled into the office at that moment, in response to the manager's summons, and stood waiting in front of the desk. "Kaufman, here," said the manager, "is our expert. What he doesn't know about wigs isn't worth knowing." Then, turning to the old man, he handed him the red wig. "Remember it, Kaufman?" The old man looked at it doubtfully. Then he gazed at the ceiling. "Red wig, red wig," he muttered. "About 2 years old, isn't it?" prompted the manager. "Not quite. Year and a half, I'd say. Looks like a comedy character type. Wait till I think. There ain't been so many of our customers playing that kind of a part inside a year and a half. Let's see. Let's see." The old man paced up and down the office, muttering names under his breath. Suddenly, he stopped, snapping his fingers. "I have it," he said. "It must have been Morley who bought that wig. That's who it was. Harold Morley. He is playing in Shakespearean repertoire with Hamlin's company. Very fussy about his wigs. Has to have them just so. I remember he bought this one because he came in here about a month ago and ordered another just like it." "Why would he do that?" asked Mr. Hardy. Kaufman shrugged his shoulders. "Ain't none of my business. Lots of actors keep a double set of wigs. Morley's playing down at the Crescent Theater right now. Call him up." "I'll go and see him," said Mr. Hardy, rising. "You're sure he is the man who ordered that wig?" "Positive," replied Kaufman, looking hurt. "I know every wig that goes out of my shop. I give him all my personal attention. Morley got the wig, and he got another like it a month ago. I remember." "Kaufman is right," put in the manager. "Morley has a very good account with us. If Kaufman says he remembers the wig, it must be so." "Well, thank you for your trouble," answered Fenton Hardy. "I may be able to see Mr. Morley in his dressing room if I hurry. It lacks about half an hour of theater time. You'll just about make it. Glad to have been of service, Mr. Hardy. Anytime we can do anything for you, just ask." "Thank you," and Fenton Hardy shook hands with Kaufman and the manager, then left the office, bound for the Crescent Theater. But the detective's hopes were not as high as they had been. He knew that Morley, the actor, was certainly not the man who had worn the wig on the day the roadster was stolen, for the Shakespearean company of which Morley was a member had been playing a 3 months run in New York. It would be impossible for the actor to get away from the theater long enough for such an escapade, just as it was improbable that he would even try to do so. He presented his card to a suspicious doorman at the Crescent and was finally admitted backstage and shown down a brilliantly lighted corridor to the dressing room of Harold Morley. It was a snug little place, the dressing room, for Morley had fitted it up to suit his own tastes once it was assured that the company would remain at the Crescent for an extended run. There were pictures on the walls, a potted plant in the window overlooking the alleyway, and a rug on the floor. Seated before a mirror with electric lights at either side, was a stout little man, almost totally bald. He was diligently rubbing cold cream on his face, and when Fenton Hardy entered he did not turn around but, eyeing his visitor in the mirror, casually told him to sit down. "Often heard of you, Mr. Hardy," he said, in a surprisingly deep voice that had a comical effect in contrast to his diminutive appearance. "Often heard of you. Glad to meet you. What kind of call is this? Social, or professional?" "Professional." Morley continued rubbing cold cream on his jowls. "Spill it," he said briefly. "What's it all about? Ever see this wig before?" asked Mr. Hardy, tossing the red wig on the table. Morley turned from the mirror, and an expression of delight crossed his plump countenance. "Well, I'll say I've seen it before," he declared. "Old Kaufman, the best wig maker in the country, made that for me about a year and a half ago. That's the kind of wig I wear for Lancelot Gobbo and the Merchant of Venice. Where did you get it? I sure didn't think I'd ever see that wig again." "Why?" "Stolen from me. Some low-down egg cleaned out my dressing room one night. During the performance. Nerviest thing I ever heard of. Came right in here while I was doing my stuff out front, grabbed my watch and money and a diamond ring I had lying by the mirror, took this wig and a couple of others that were lying around, and beat it. Nobody saw him come or go. Must have got him by that window." Morley talked in short, rapid sentences, and there was no mistaking his sincerity. "How many wigs did he take?" "About half a dozen. Funny thing about that, too. They were all red. Took nothing but red wigs. I told the cops to be on the lookout for a red-headed thief. I didn't worry so much about the other wigs, for they were for old plays, but this one was being used right along. Kaufman made it specially for me. I had to get him to make another. But say, where did you find it?" "Oh, just a little case I'm investigating. The crook left this behind him. I was trying to trace it." "Well, you've traced it all right. But that's all the help I can give you. The cops never did find out who cleaned out my dressing room." Mr. Hardy was disappointed. The clue of the red wig had led only to a blind alley. But he concealed his chagrin and tossed the wig over to Morley. "Gee, and I'm sure glad to get it back again," declared the actor. "Things haven't gone right with me at all since I lost that wig. Losing it brought me a whole flock of bad luck. Sorry I can't help you find the guy that took it. What's he been up to now?" Fenton Hardy evaded the question. "Oh, I'll probably get him some other way. Give me a list and description of the stuff he took from you. Probably I can trace him through that." "Hop to it," said Morley breezily. "Hop right to it, old man. Here's a list of the stuff right here." He reached in a drawer and drew out a sheet of paper which he handed over to the detective. "That's the same list I gave to the cops when I reported the robbery. Number of the watch, and everything." Mr. Hardy folded the list and put it in his pocket. Morley glanced at his watch, lying beside the mirror, face up, and gave an exclamation. "Suffering Sebastopol. Curtain in 5 minutes and I'm not half made up yet. Excuse me, Mr. Hardy, but I've got to get busy. In this business I'll be ready in a minute doesn't go." He seized a stick of grease paint and feverishly resumed the task of altering his appearance to that of the character he was portraying at the matinee that day. Mr. Hardy, smiling at the actor's casual informality, withdrew from the dressing room and made his way out to the street. "A blind alley," he muttered. "I was sure I could trace the fellow by means of the wig. Oh, well." He shrugged his shoulders. "I still have the hat and coat. And if the worst comes to the worst I can try to trace the chap through the stuff he stole from Morley, for it was probably the same man. But it looks like a big job. It was a big job. Efforts to trace the purchaser of the hat and coat were fruitless. The search ended at a second-hand store where the owner vainly tried to sell Mr. Hardy a complete outfit of clothing at a bargain, but could not or would not remember who had bought the coat from him. He sold so many coats, and at such bargains, that he could not remember the customers who came into his store. Mr. Hardy was forced to retire, defeated. The predominating quality of the detective's character was patience. When he found that he could not trace the thief through the wig, the hat or the coat, he doggedly set to work trying to trace the man who had broken into the dressing room of the actor, morally, and this, in spite of the fact that the police had already given up that case as hopeless. Then, in his spare time, Mr. Hardy spent hours at police headquarters, poring over records, searching for particulars of hundreds of red-headed criminals. It was over a week before he found what he wanted, and it came from a chance note at the bottom of a police description of a thief who was at that time out on parole. But when Fenton Hardy saw the note, he knew he had stumbled on the clue he needed. And he smiled grimly. "It won't be long now," he remarked, in the popular phrase of the day, as he went back to his hotel.